things with the new director. Anything relevant to CFAS that we should know about? I am inviting him to the CFAS meeting. For those of you who don't know, NIAAA has a new director now, Dr. George Koob. And so hopefully he'll be at our meeting.
Nothing new on this end. We've gone to some efforts to inform him of CFAS and doing, and
he's been pretty busy getting up to speed.
I hear he's attending meetings and having meetings and everything else. So I think everybody in NIAAA is getting meetinged out.
Well, he also claims to abhor any meeting with more than three people. So we don't do meetings that small. But we're trying to find our way there.
I'm going to meet up with him on Sunday, so get his impression of it so far. But he took the Collins approach and said that he was too busy to even look outside the window.
So right.
The weather was relevant. All right. I apologize for last week, but to the president's office, and I apologize for today because I have to leave at 10:30 because I have been summoned to my dean's office. We are in heavy good negotiations. So at the Gordon conference next week, this was the time the dean could meet with me. So I need to leave exactly at 10:30, and then Jennifer will take over. There are not a lot of news. I was hoping that Peter would be on.
I am on.
Peter, you're there. I have a favor to ask. The London College of Physicians is having an art exhibit on alcohol. And I would really like a brochure if they have one.
Right.
If you're running by the London College of Physicians, and it looks interesting on the web, but if they have a brochure of the exhibition, I would appreciate a copy, and I'd pay you for that.
Okay.
I see you at the face-to-face meeting.
I'll look into it.
Appreciate it. And in a relevant topic, anyone has any great slides of paintings depicting aspects of fetal alcohol syndrome, I would appreciate them, right? Ken Warren, I, and Peggy Murray are trying to put something together on the art of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So if anyone has any of those slides or things like that, it would be greatly appreciated.
Hey, Ed, I think Kathy in the past has herself painted a portrait or two showing the face of FAS. You might want to ask her.
Well, we were kind of looking at how FAS has shown up in literature and art over the years, over the centuries.
Yeah.
And not so much, you know, here's what the thing looks like.
Yeah. Well, you know, she may have some ideas.
Yeah, so I will be in touch with her. But there's a Lautrec painting that DeHaene wrote a paper on time, in which he shows a picture of Bordello and picks out one particular woman and believes that she has fetal alcohol syndrome. And the only woman in the painting has on a very non-provocative outfit.
I'm getting a lot of breakup, Ed.
I'm sorry. This Toulouse-Lautrec painting shows women in a bordello, and I think it was DeHaene who wrote an article on one woman in particular who he thinks has fetal alcohol syndrome, and she's the only woman in this bordello scene who doesn't have a provocative outfit on, and she has a very thin face. She has no upper lip, no philtrum.
and he believes that she was probably the daughter of one of the women in the bordello who was an alcoholic and has fetal alcohol syndrome. And so things like that, you know, if you know of anything like that, that'd be great. We're just thinking about this as a possibility. All right, the face-to-face meeting is going to be April 6th to 9th. I don't get in until a little, I think, after 6 o'clock into DCA, and so I'm not sure if we will be having anything on Sunday night, but I will keep you informed on that. The meeting's going to adjourn at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, except for the Science Advisory Board, who I hope can stay for Tuesday evening, so we can discuss the progress. All the progress reports are due to the NIH on April 1st, and please send us copies of those as well. Jill, do you have everyone's progress report for the meeting? And
hello?
Jill. Hello.
Yeah, we have the Science Advisory Board has received the progress reports that were collected previous to April 1st. Yes.
All right, but we're not missing anything.
From the ones that were already collected, no.
Well, from the ones that were already collected, I know we're not missing anything, but from the people in CFAS, we have everyone that we have need, right?
Sorry, I'm so not sure what you're asking. I apologize.
I understand. All right, we'll talk later about that. All right, so since I have to leave in a little bit, I'd like to like Shana to do the presentation. Because I'd like to hear that, and so if
okay, well, this is Elizabeth, and Shantanu is an engineer, an assistant professor at UCLA, and he and I started working together on the brain and the face when I was still at UCLA, and he submitted a K99, and it didn't get funded, but he's still working with me and Catherine Narr on the data, hoping to get some funding to keep doing it. So, Shantanu?
All right. So, hi, everyone. I'll just be presenting some preliminary results that we have based on the past work that we've done. It's been published at a conference, actually OHBM, but there's no manuscript yet. So, this is the outline. It just has two main sections, the past work, the preliminary results, and the proposed research ideas. So I just have three slides on the future research work, but yeah, I'd be glad to hear your inputs on that. So in the preliminary results, we looked at the corpus callosum morphology in FASD and looked at corpus callosum in conjunction with facial features. Then we looked at the cortical folding patterns, the gyrification in FASD and its conjunction with facial anthropomorphic features again. And lastly, we did some FASD diagnostic classification using joint face and brain features, again based on gyrification, so I'll just talk about it. So this is the data that we used. I guess all of you know what this data is, so I won't spend too much time. So 114 subjects at three sites, LA, San Diego, and Cape Town. So we look at corpus callosum dysmorphology. I'm actually not explaining the method that we used for shape analysis in detail here. I'll be happy to talk about it later. So here, we pooled all the subjects together, traced their corpus callosum, and analyzed their shape in a discriminative fashion. What I'm showing on the slide is significant group differences for a shape covariation in FASD. So if you see the left picture, we are actually showing the group differences due to an eigen shape, which is the eighth. And so what... Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, can... I hear some music. I don't know...
Me too. I hear music. I hear you. Any?
Someone's probably switched.
Is everybody still here?
Yeah.
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 With
yeah.
music.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So,
did somebody go on hold or something?
Yeah, I think so. I think somebody must have. That's what
all right.
It sounds like.
I can try muting everyone except for the line that's presenting.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Okay, and that's the 310 line?
Yes.
Just try them one at a time.
Yeah.
I'm going through them.
That's
okay,
it.
Okay, great. So the idea here is we pool all the shapes together, and if you are familiar with PCA, which people have done for use for discriminative analysis, and so PCA works on real numbers in the Euclidean plane, what we're doing is shape PCA. So we're doing PCA except for shapes. So we have to have a nonlinear manifold where each shape is a point. And then we treat shapes as elements and actually do PCA on the shapes. So we can have a discriminative relationship between shape and any other covariate you want to include in the model. So here we are looking at group differences for the eighth eigen vector for shape. And you can see significant group differences here. And all the three sides are presented. And then the second picture shows significant side effects for eigen shape 3. And so this is a discriminative shape axis which tells different sides apart. The second slide, we have significant group effects, or significant differences in groups for only the LA and the SD population here shown for eigenvector 7. So somehow that eigenvector is actually able to tease out the differences between Los Angeles and San Diego shapes of the corpus callosum. And these are how the eigen shape variations look like. So if you actually plot the eigen axis and plot the original shape from the population, how they would actually appear to vary. Going from top to bottom, you see how they vary across the spectrum. And it is these variations, so eigen vector 3 for site, 8 for group, and 7 for group differences between LA and San Diego. And so it's these eigen variations that we want to look or we want to look in conjunction with facial features. And so the next slide does exactly that. So here we see shape correlations with facial anthropomorphic features. And so the first one is the lipometer, and the third eigenvector, and with an R of 0.51, significant correlation. And the second picture is the palpebral fissure length, eighth eigenvector, again 0.53, significant shape correlations. So this work was presented at OHBM 2012. So moving on to the cortex, and here we're looking at the cortical folding patterns. So just a brief slide on why do gyrification in FAS, and you can see a typical control brain here and a FAS brain for 5 and 11 years. And so we know FAS is a developmental disorder, and so there are large changes in gyrification in utero. And so, so far, not a lot of studies. In fact, there's only one preliminary study that has actually looked at gyrification in FAS, and their sample size was, I think, maybe 15 subjects or so. So here we're looking at all 114 subjects in the population. Here's another slide on how the cortex, when extracted from the MRI image, looks like for control subjects in FAS. And so you can see, The FAS subjects have a significantly reduced gyrification.
Are these
on the
samples
cortex.
Or averages?
These are actually individual subjects.
Okay.
This is an individual subject also. So For gyrification, we use the method by Marie Shire, who has extended the 2D gyrification by Zeles et al. To 3D. And what we've done here is actually renormalized their method so that when you change the size of the brain, the gyrification is invariant to the size of the brain, which is not there in that case, in their implementation. So this is the effect of alcohol exposure on gyrification. And all of these, so you have controls greater than patients in red. So you have significantly reduced gyrification in the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe for patients compared to controls. And so this is done by fitting a linear model and finding out the main effect of alcohol exposure, covariating for age, sex, and sight. And all of these results are corrected for multiple comparisons using FDR. The second slide shows the effect of IQ on gyrification. Same model as before. And these subjects here are alcohol-exposed subjects, so the contrast is full-face diagnosis versus no diagnosis. So full FAS versus no FAS. The third slide.
I'm sorry, can you go back a minute to that last slide?
Yeah.
Is it just that the full-face diagnosis has a lower IQ than the no diagnosis? Is that why it's between IQ?
Yes, yes. So full face is less than no facial dysmorphology, or mild facial.
Look at correlations. Can you look at correlations with? I'm just because the title says effective IQ. I'm just wondering if it is really the effective diagnosis, and but you could also look at IQ as a correlation to the terrification.
Yes. So when you say correlation, you mean you still have to control for sex, age, and sight. So instead of fitting a full linear model, you just want to look at the correlation, is what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. We'll look at that also.
We're happy to talk to you about that, Sarah.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting. It's just I got stuck on the title that it says you.
So is the result of that it's actually the effect of alcohol or the effect of a full-face diagnosis?
Yes.
Because it's only within the alcohol-exposed subjects, John, so it's not the effect of alcohol, but the effect of facial dysmorphology.
Of the dysmorphology. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't understand this. Could you please repeat?
Well, I'm following up on Sarah's question, I think, is what's depicted here in the scale of red is a change in IQ or a change in gyrification?
So it is the main effect of IQ in gyrification. So it's of course, change in gyrification due to IQ.
Or it could be due to having the face versus not. But we can, good question. We can talk about that.
Yes.
Okay, so it wasn't controlled for IQ.
We are looking at the main effect of IQ.
Okay. So the full-face diagnosis and IQ are co-varying together, and so both of those factors are in this color coding?
Okay. The subjects here are only alcohol-exposed subjects. So the subjects are not controls. There are no controls here.
No, but you've made a distinction between having a full face or not.
Right. That is probably qualitative. So I didn't exactly know the variation of the face in the subject. So this was a category, full face or no face. And so I just used that variable here.
Yeah. Well,
okay, we can move on.
Yeah,
we can figure that out.
All right. So then we're looking at the relation of the gyrification to dysmorphology. And so for, again, only controls and patients. We're looking at the correlation or the partial correlation of the frontal pole gyrification with respect to the palpebral fissure length and the lipometer. So you see significant correlations for the gyrification when controlled for sex, age, and site here. So this is a partial residual plot, actually. So shall I move on?
Yeah, just one thing. It looks relatively symmetric to me, is it?
Symmetric, you mean bilateral?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll just move on. So this was gyrification. This was presented last year. Actually, the date is, the year is wrong. It's 2013, last year at OHBM. Then we tried, we asked the question if we can diagnose FASD or try to diagnose FASD using joint face and brain features. And so this is really preliminary. So what we did is did a stratified sampling of the controls and patients and did 100 trials using bootstrapping, same data. And what I'm showing is the ROC curve for classification performance of FASD for the palpebral fissure length as the facial measure. And so we did a logistic regression with PFL and the frontal pole gyrification, and both of them combined together. So if you see the blue curve, it's just the gyrification. And obviously, it's not so predictive. And the green curve is actually the facial the feature, the PFL. And so, if you want to diagnose FAS just based on PFL, that's how your performance would look like, average performance. And then when we combine both gyrification, so PFL and FP, we get the red curve, the orange curve, which has a higher area under the curve, AUC, compared to both of those measures.
Can you think of that as a percent correct classification, or is that not?
We have to answer that question. We should look at both the sensitivity and the specificity of it. So here I'm just showing the average value. So this is correlated to the percent average correct, yes.
You can also think of it as the probability of correctly classifying a pair, one each randomly selected from the exposed and the non-exposed.
Yes.
And is palpebral fissure length, yes, short, yes or no? Is that how you're classifying it, or are you using the actual percentile?
I think we are using the percentile. I'm not sure. Maybe Elizabeth or someone else could be.
My recollection is that we did the actual length in millimeters.
The millimeters. Okay.
Yeah, it would have to be a continuous variable.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. It was. Continuous. Okay, so that's all for the preliminary results. So here are a few proposed future ideas, and maybe everyone can weigh in and see what they think. So one idea is to do a tangent PCA for the joint, corpus callosum, and the facial landmarks. And here, I think, so Peter is an expert on these facial morphometry, and I'd really love to hear his input or his ideas on how we could combine the brain features and the facial features. Here's an attempt where one can actually project the corpus callosum and the facial landmarks. So here I'm using landmarks, but maybe there are other better ideas to actually incorporate facial morphometry. And project the facial landmarks and the corpus callosum in shape space and construct a unified tangent space for both of them and find a joint covariation for the corpus callosum and the facial curves that will allow you to actually define a shape metric. So this may be a bit technical here, but the idea is, again, going back to the PCA analogy for numbers, instead of doing PCA on numbers, you're doing PCA on shape. And here you're doing joint PCA on corpus callosum and the facial landmarks. So this is the idea here. So the method. Sorry.
I'm a bit confused. You're saying facial landmarks, but actually you're using curves.
That's right. So I'm just assuming that these curves are the facial landmarks themselves.
Oh, I see. I understand. So not landmarks in the classical sense. They're just features.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Features. That's
yeah.
Right. Landmark features.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Probably best to change the word.
Yeah. Maybe you're right. Yeah.
And Shantanu, what is this reference here in schizophrenia? Is this figure published or?
No. So the corpus callosum work was actually presented in published in NeuroImage last
okay.
year.
But not in the FAS sample.
Not in the FAS sample, and yeah, we've actually never looked at FAS, the corpus callosum in FAS, yet. The second idea is actually doing combined subcortical and facial morphometry. And there are a lot of things happening on this slide. So one is, again, going back to I think Peter's suggestion about facial features, maybe instead of curve landmarks, you have or curve features, you have region features, like ROI features on face. And this is, again, just an example. So we could have, like, the surface area, for instance, or the local curvatures for various ROIs delineated on the face and correlate them with either thickness, volume, gyrification, and so on the brain. So this is the ROI to ROI analysis, both on face and both on the brain. The other idea, so there are two ideas on this slide. Sorry for making it cluttered. So this is one idea, actually correlating brain ROIs and face ROIs. And the other idea is using a subcortical structure, a focused structure like a hippocampus or amygdala, and actually looking at the facial, looking at correlations of shape of the hippocampus, for instance, with the facial features. So the hippocampal work here actually was published in this conference, MFCA. And so here we're just looking at a new method for doing shape analysis of the hippocampus. And so, again, we've not integrated face into that
Excellent.
Yet.
I'm going to have...
How did you get the...
I apologize that I have to leave. Jennifer will take over after this is done, but I'm really sorry, but I don't have a choice on this matter. So
no problem, Ed. Thanks.
Take care.
Right. So to my last slide, this is the most ambitious of all of these things. So to have a joint cortical and a facial warping pipeline. So this pipeline has two stages, the top and the bottom. And the bottom stage is concerned with brain warping, cortical surface morphometry. And the top stage is concerned with facial morphometry. And this pipeline, I just have sketched a schematic of how this pipeline should look like, but I've actually also looked at Peter's work, and maybe we can also incorporate or integrate his analysis into this pipeline as well, I mean, if he thinks it's appropriate. And so here the idea is to do a combined covariation again of facial and brain morphometry in a single setting. And so the brain part was actually published in IEEE DMI 2 years ago. Again, we have not incorporated face into this yet. So this is all I have.
That's really amazing stuff, Shantanu.
So any questions or anything?
Well, I was wondering, going back to the first, to the PCA analyses where you're generating several eigenvectors.
Right.
And, for example, there was a slide where you had multiple outlines in red. That one. In the red and the blue. I'm wondering why there's different numbers of reds and blues in each of the lines. Because I interpreted that as being the number of subjects that were categorized as alcohol exposed or not.
That's right. So the blue is alcohol exposed, and the reds are controls.
And so does that mean that it looks like you're doing different types of analyses on – maybe I'm not understanding what the eigenvector is. I'm just wondering why each of the 3, 8, and 7 have different numbers of reds and blues in it. If I'm trying to explain this to the public, you know.
I think they have the same in total. It's just that they're in different positions, you know, according to the value of that they score on the eigenvalue.
No, I counted them up, and there's a different number in each column.
Oh, are there?
So, okay.
Right, so, there are.
So here, if you look at zero, this is where the mean shape for the whole population would center. And I'm not actually showing the mean shape here. I should show the mean shape. What I'm showing is the extreme left, so plus 3 times square root of sigma, and the extreme right, minus 3 times square root of sigma, original shapes from the population that coincide with the eigenshape direction. So these are so think of this like if you look at the PCA.
Are these subsets of your sample?
Yes, these are subsets of the sample.
Yeah, these are the tails.
The tail end,
yes,
of the
distribution. I see.
Yes. And site is actually, the color coding of alcohol control is not as relevant because there was a main effect of site. So really one should have color coded
right.
it as site. But
yes,
you can clearly see in the one tail, the corpus callosums are much thinner and longer perhaps. And in the other tail, they are flatter. More bulbous. For eigen 8, that was a main effective group, and you can see that there are more blue corpus callosums in the top tail and more red ones in the bottom, and then likewise for eigen 7.
Well, I'm not so sure there is a different number in number 7. It looks there's 3 red ones in both sides. So if you're trying to communicate this to the public or me,
right,
what does an eighth eigenvector shape mean?
So the eighth eigen shape means if you look at all your population at once, if you plot all of your corpus callosi in a single picture, and if you only look at the corpus callosum or the corpus callosi, which show this kind of a elongated to bulbous effect in the population, and if you pick them out, then mathematically we can describe this variation by eigen 8. That's what it means.
So when you said elongated with bulbous ends, is that what's the shape that's being described by the eighth eigenvector?
That's right. So that's actually picking out the shape variation in that direction.
I see. Okay.
And Shantanu, you define the callosa automatically, right? Or did someone trace them?
I think these were manually traced, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I've seen Peter do movies where you sort of morph from the average control to the average exposed. Didn't you do that with the callosum to sort of?
Oh, yes. They are in the paper that we published, yes. The deformations, you mean?
Yeah, but not in alcohol exposed. That was a different population.
No, not in alcohol exposed, no.
I mean, that's something that that could help sort of illustrate what's happening. So if you could see a movie shifting from what's more control-like.
Right,
more
right.
Exposed. Yeah, right. I mean, in these graphs, one could have plotted every single corpus callosum in the sample.
Right.
So we're just showing the tails. And even though the last tail might seem like it has equal numbers of blue and red, I mean, those are just the two extreme ends of the But you have to interpret what the shape means. And the eigen 8, 7, and 3, those numbers are just arbitrary, obviously, because it could be you run it again and it dimensionalizes differently, but it should still pull out a shape that is characteristic of FAS, which might be diagnostic or so on, relate to particular facial features. And this is just a 2D structure, so.
It's a what structure?
It's two-dimensional.
Okay,
so,
2D,
yeah.
2D, okay.
So Shantanu is working, I believe, on a manuscript with the sulcal patterning.
The gyrification, yes, that's okay. Right.
And we have not worked on developing the corpus callosum stuff into a publication.
Not right? yet. Right.
I mean, I guess part of our limitation is that Shantanu is, you know, he's still at UCLA and working with Catherine and other folks there, but his money, you know, I'm not asking for money or anything because Ed's not there, so. But, I mean, you know, the point being that this is really exciting stuff, and he's working on the thing that seems the most interesting, which is the sulcal patterning. But I'm just saying that we don't necessarily have the resources for him to follow through on. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, the point is that he would like to get funding, but some
right.
has to be done.
It's Michael, and, you know, I'm in my car, so I missed all the beautiful pictures, and I'd like to see them at some point. I think that we could discuss further the possibilities of, you know, submitting a pilot project or something like that.
Yeah. Shantanu actually did a K99 ROO, and unfortunately it didn't pass muster. He's working now on a, what is that grant, Shantanu?
It's the ABMRF, the Alcohol Research Foundation.
But anyway, I mean, it would be so awesome if he could.
But ABMRF is, you know, it's about the same size as the pilot project.
Uh-huh.
So that's another good option.
Yeah. You mean a pilot project within CFAST or?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, within CFAST. That's a mechanism we have. We have to sort of put those out again soon, and it's obviously an open competition, but those are potential mechanisms, and ABMRF is another good one. Fetal alcohol has never been in the center of their vision, but they have funded fetal alcohol projects in the past.
Are you looking for funding to continue analysis of data you've already collected, or to do more scans?
Data already collected.
So that would fall under an RO3, perhaps, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's...
For follow-up analyses?
Really good
yeah.
idea.
That is a good
yeah.
idea.
Yeah. You know, how much funding is really needed to complete the work? I mean, what really would it take?
Oh, well, I would, you know, maybe Shantanu can send you his slides, but the idea is, I mean, like, if he were to have some time to write two papers, one on the corpus callosum and one on the sulcal shape, that wouldn't be a lot, but to pursue it further based on his ideas, you know, certainly salary support for Shantanu would be key. I guess, right?
Yeah, well, it's a dedicated effort.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all on soft money, or maybe not all of us, but... So, Shantanu is committed on other projects, and to pursue this, it has to be done. That's why it hasn't had the momentum that...
That's what I was trying to say when I was babbling earlier. It's, you know, it doesn't have the momentum because his, you know, funding is on other projects.
Right, but it certainly has, I mean, it's exciting and potentially high yield and different, innovative.
This is Dale, and I have to admit half of this is going over my head, but it seems like you... This has given you a good opportunity to generate some preliminary data that you could, of course, use in an RO3 application or other form of application to seek that funding. And I agree with Michael that it sounds like one option would be a developmental project within CFAS. And that operates on one schedule, and then getting an RO3, as you know, that can be a half year long endeavor,
just right,
with the timing of the cycles.
So, Shantanu, how far are you from a draft of the focal shape one?
I'm not so far from it, right? So I'm pretty close.
I think that would be pretty important to submit an RO3 to have something published, and I feel like that is the closest. Right, Catherine and Roger have been working with you on it too?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with this.
Yeah.
All right. Really cool.
So the other thing we wanted to address was interfacing with the 3D data, right, to pursue some of the novel things.
Yes. And how that interacts with Peter's plans and analyses and...
Right.
Yeah.
To make sure that there's some distinction and collaboration.
Right. Yes.
But, I mean, even with, with the human measurement, from Ken's visits or whatever, there's some interesting suggestions about where to look in the face. But again, Peter, do you have any thoughts?
I have a slightly negative thought on using the raw principal components, in that they're not, although they're mathematically independent, that you can have overlapping shape variation of, in some parts of the total shape that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So I must say, when we do the face work, I don't trust just looking at individual principal components. I prefer to look at the overall shape and not just what one principal component gives you.
Okay.
And then the other comment I would make is, the curves that Shantanu was outlining in that future work,
yeah,
I'm not so sure. I think some of them look like they would be useful, but some of them look like they might be artifacts,
Yeah.
But it could be just, they could just be arising from shadows on the face.
Yeah.
So I would just take care with which ones you choose.
Okay.
Like, there's one on the chin, for instance, and I just don't know whether that's well-defined.
Right.
I guess we would have to do is...
It's just an example, right?
Yeah.
It's just an idea. Point,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's very similar to what we've done in the past on the brain, defining sulcal landmarks as contours and using those to match subjects. And so it was just an idea if we could do something like that on the face.
So a few of these curve features can be diagnostic, and a few of these can be purely auxiliary for guiding the warping or the facial surface warping.
Go to your next slide again, Shantanu. You show the whole – oh, no, the next one. So if you see these flat maps, the squares, the face on the top, planar mapping, and the brain – bottom. So the idea is that you can use those landmarks to then warp the face. Again, this is an idea to match the face across all subjects based on those landmarks, and then look at what's in between, right? The whole face.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Other questions or comments? Well, we have about 10 more minutes. And we can just wrap up with progress. And so Elizabeth, Ed or Jill sent out the sorry about that. Can everyone hear me now?
Better.
Oh, okay. We'll just take a look at the updates on progress. And so, Elizabeth, if you want to have anything to update us beyond the data that we've just seen.
Well, it's not really an update, but while I've got Jeff and Sarah on the phone, I mean, we have quite a corpus of data from CFAS 3, and I think we had talked about waiting till all sites get all time one, but I think we're pretty close to that. So I, you know, that's something we should talk about as a group on how to maybe move forward with some of that.
Okay. Is that probably more of an offline conversation, or you think?
Yeah, I think that an offline conversation. But I just wanted to say that's a place where we could consider going in the short run.
Okay.
Yeah, our group meeting is not too long from now, and it may be a good venue for having that discussion,
mm-hmm.
showing what we have, and I think that's a good opportunity to get everybody together. And
I agree. Yeah.
I have to sign off for my next meeting, but thanks to everybody. Bye.
Thank you, Michael.
Bye, Michael.
Bye, Michael.
Bye. So I don't have the roster, but is Tina on?
I am. So, Dale will ask, is the current situation in Ukraine is sort of pretty much the same, although business is going on, what we talk to them pretty much every week, and although the ministry people are calling in sick every day, the rank and file is coming into work, and they're slowly doing neurobehavioral testing for local kids who can come in because of the weather, and getting speed up to speed with Claire and Julie working with them on a weekly basis on Skype. We sent our samples, the carefully selected samples of mid-trimester and third trimester, to Raj Miranda at Texas A&M. So he's got kids who are exposed and affected, kids who are exposed and appear to be unaffected, and unexposed, unaffected. And so he's looking at the amount of resources he has, and the best approach to try to attack this in a smart way. And then we finally got our agreement on how the 3D images are going to be handled in a confidential and secure manner, so that Peter and Tatiana can actually get the images. So we sent the letter outlining how these will be handled to them, and they are tell us they're in the process of mailing the flash drives with the images on them to Jeff at Indiana. And that's it. We're taking planning, if all goes well, to take Mark Coit at Gilbert with us to Ukraine the week before the face-to-face meeting in Washington, D.C., who is Kathy Sulik's postdoc.
Okay, thanks, Tina. Any questions for Tina? Then Peter or Tatiana, do you have any updates?
I don't think Tatiana's on, is she?
No,
she's not.
No.
Okay.
No. Well, I won't say anything in great detail because in 3 weeks' time we'll be the people presenting, to the group on the call. But we've been repeating the pediatrics paper analysis we did on Sandy Jacobson data. We've been applying that same analysis to the Caucasian data from the US, and so far that's looking pretty good, although because of some imbalances in the numbers, we've had to add some of our own controls from the UK in order to be able to do the normalization properly. On the the past data front, we've been provided with 200 pairs of images. That's pairs in sense of 1 month and 1 year. And they are unclassified, although we know that 100 of them are exposed and 100 of them are unexposed, but we don't know which. And the idea is we're going to do a blind analysis of those alongside 92 other pairs that we've been given, which are identified as unexposed. And that's ongoing analysis. Some of you may not know, but we've started a 3D ultrasound experiment with some people at Oxford as a pilot project, and that started at the beginning of the year. And the expert there is Alison Noble, who Shantanu might know because they go to the same conferences.
Oh, yes. That's nice.
And one of her PhD students, Tom Rackham, who's just finishing, has taken time out to work on this for about 5 months. And after a month, he's already getting some nice midline facial profiles from the 3D ultrasounds, and he's gradually going to start moving into getting a face surface out, and we're going to see what we can do with those. We just have a small sample of images, about 25 from the past network people in South Africa, and I think that's about it.
Oh, and Peter, another thing is that we're sending you the brain data.
Oh, yes,
right?
I'm sorry, yes, I forgot to say that. Yes, we've been working with, liaising with Elizabeth to get some MRI images so we can also have a go at some face brain work, probably focusing on corpus callosum, I think. We had a go with just a very small, almost a handful of samples, of examples from Sandy Jacobson, that looked promising, so the idea now is to try and do the same thing with a larger sample.
Now, the other thing that I want to bring up that we should talk about is right now we're just sending CFAS2 data, the raw data, so you can do your stuff. Like I just said, we've got a large corpus of children from CFAS3, and we have to, as a group, decide if, you know, should we pool that in the things that you're doing sooner than later, something we should talk about.
Is that something we could talk about at the face-to-face, or would you?
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I'm just ideas that we should just.
Okay. Sarah? Any updates?
I think she had to leave early.
Oh, did she? Okay. So we have Johan?
Yeah, so I guess the best latest update is I just got tenure. So that's
hey, congratulations.
Great.
Congratulations.
And then in other news, the most exciting stuff right now is that our forward genetic mutants, we're getting many of them into the sequencing queue of our facility now. We have two of them back. One of them we've ran through our mapping program, and it looks like it is a mutation in a gene, DUSP1, which is kind of exciting in light of some of Michael's work showing that MAP signaling might regulate L1 phenotypes because DUSP1 is very important in dephosphorylating components of the MAP kinase. So it would be expected to have elevated levels of MAP signaling. So we're investigating that right now.
Okay. All right, any questions for Johan? Or any final comments from the advisory board or NIAAA? It sounds like people have been dropping out.
Nope, I'm fine.
No comments here from me.
Okay.
Or Bill. Bill shaking his head.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right, well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for the presentation, Shantanu. That was really interesting. So I guess that's it for today.
All right. See you soon.
Great. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.